You're going to war with a corporation that owns a day of the week.
No proof was presented today because there simply isn't any.
They have to listen to us. This is bigger than they are.
Those voices are from the movie Concussion, which tells the story of how Dr. Bennett Omalu's discovery of chronic traumatic encephalopathy in the brains of former NFL players was ridiculed by the league's doctors. The movie won't be out until December, but the trailer came out this week, and that gives us a dramatic place to start our discussion of Three Stories You Should Know. My guests are Patrick Ruby of Vice Sports and Shira Springer, who writes about sports for the Boston Globe. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Howdy.
Patrick, you're the only one of the three of us who's actually seen Concussion, so I'm going to leave it to you to explain the controversy that's already surrounding the film 3 months before its release.
Earlier this week, we had a New York Times report on the making of the film. And the report itself, it was based on a series of leaked emails from the big Sony studio hack last year.
Mm-hmm.
And this Times report basically suggested that Concussion was softened at the behest of the NFL. Now, I don't think that's quite what happened. And I say that for two reasons. First, I have seen the movie. It is not soft on the NFL. It's not. It's not even soft on the game of football. On top of that, I actually looked at all the same emails that the Times is talking about, and I didn't actually see any evidence of the NFL muscling Sony. What I did see was a studio, you know, Sony's pushing for Oscars here, and they know if they're going to do that, credibility is huge. And Sony had their in-house lawyers go over the script, especially those NFL parts. So I see this as a lot of empty hullabaloo, and I'm personally more interested in seeing how people feel about the NFL and about football when they come out of the theater. Because a movie like this, it can connect with people in that storytelling way that even something like League of Denial, the documentary, or any piece of journalism that I might write can connect with people.
Shira, are you surprised that we're so quick to believe that the NFL had some secret powerful influence in the movie making? I mean, it's not like they've ever tried to keep information like this from getting out before. But, wait, I'm wrong.
Yes, that's exactly what I was going to bring up. And Patrick actually mentioned the League of Denial. You know, this was a project that ESPN was originally attached to. And as we know, ESPN broadcasts NFL games. And under pressure from the NFL, they removed their name from the documentary. I also think we're in this deflategate mode where can you really trust the NFL at its word? You know, I think there are a number of surveys going out now around the country asking just that. Do you trust the NFL? And the NFL comes up as one of the least trusted organizations, corporate organizations in the country.
All right, I want to turn now to college sports, because according to a chart that I saw this week in the paper, a scholarship football player at Tennessee arriving on campus will receive a check for $5,666. This is for full cost of attendance. A football player at Syracuse, on the other hand, will get $1,632. That's quite a gap. So another reason for players not even to look at the course catalog, they're just looking at how much money they're going to get in addition to their scholarships. It doesn't go far enough, though. These athletes should be paid according to what the market establishes. A blue-chip quarterback ought to get a lot. A second-string defensive lineman ought to get a little. And then they all ought to get vouchers that enable them to actually be students after they've finished playing football or basketball and making lots of money and generating lots of publicity for their respective employers. Excuse me, I don't mean employers. I mean the colleges for which they play. I'm sorry. Anyway, Patrick, what do you think about this week's figures in the paper and these developments?
I mean, look, I would love to argue with you, but of course I agree with you 100%. And this is like one of my pet issues. I definitely think there should be a free and fair market. In terms of the actual cost of attendance thing, one thing I like to point out, for years and years and years and years and just about forever, the NCAA has argued, and it's argued in court, not just in the court of public opinion, we can't afford to pay cost of living stipends. Everything's going to fall apart. We'll have to cut women's lacrosse. We're going to have to shut things down. The Big Ten will drop to Division III. But what happens as soon as the rules allow cost of attendance? These schools are scrambling.
Checks are in the mail.
The whole college sports industrial complex will adjust.
Shira, you have another model in mind for this whole college athletic business, right?
I don't even know if it's another model. I say we just end the charade of college athletics.
Yeah.
I mean, separate it out. Who are we kidding at this point that football players and basketball players are student athletes? And I mean, there are other countries where athletics are a big deal and they don't use their colleges and universities as basically developmental programs for their professional sports. It's high time that the U.S. start looking at a model like that.
Shira, I understand that your topic also has to do with the distinction between professionals and amateurs. Explain, please.
It does. On Tuesday, Alana Hadley announced on Twitter that she would be running in the New York City Marathon in the elite field. Hadley is 18 years old. I worry about both her mental and physical and emotional sanity. I'm also a little bit concerned by people in my own profession who are promoting her, because I think it's unwise to set her out as an example, particularly because you see often in sports a landscape littered with teenage phenoms who haven't made it.
Tennis used to have this problem. We all remember, right?
Jennifer Capriati.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But what tennis did in terms of limiting the number of pro tournaments you could play in depending on your age and sort of creating somewhat of a runway, I think that helps. And in women's tennis especially, we haven't seen nearly as many of these like really sad burnout cases as we used to see. So maybe there could, something like that could be done in running.
You know, I'm of two minds on this. On the one hand, of course, I remember especially the female tennis players and in some cases female gymnasts and figure skaters who've all had difficult times because they've been celebrated way too early in their lives. On the other hand, 18 is 18, and in this country, you can be sent to a war when you're 18. So I don't really see how we can say somebody shouldn't run in a marathon as a professional or whatever if 18 is the age of being an adult.
Yeah, maybe the solution is she gets to run. Maybe the New York City Marathon doesn't give her an elite entry, and maybe people who cover running don't trumpet her as the
don't
next
get so
great.
Excited
exactly.
As they
don't
gotten,
hype
yeah,
her up yeah, because I think yeah, that's part of the larger issue, because she's getting all this attention. And then that attention, I think, feeds the next generation, not realizing that sometimes when you rush into it, you're sacrificing a longer, more successful career.
My guests at the roundtable this week have been Patrick Ruby of Vice Sports and Shira Springer of the Boston Globe. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.